be sufficient for Dhuhr. So Dhuhr prayer has to be offered as a measure of precaution.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law about offering the recommended prayers in congregation? As you can see, some people come to the mosque, in fact, and they would like to offer and perform some of the recommended prayers as well. So yeah. What is the Islamic law about it?
Well, it is absolutely forbidden, according to Shia, to offer any mustahab prayers in Jama'ah. Mm-hmm. In Jama'ah. And it has been prohibited and forbidden by according to, it is forbidden according to Shia teachings, according to the traditions and riwayat that we have received from the infallible imams. Of course, mm-hmm. You know, one of the, for example, mustahab prayers that are usually offered in Jama'ah by Sunni Muslims is Salat al-Taraweeh. In the month of Ramadan, you know, there are 1,000 rakahs of mustahab prayers, which are also in the Shia Islam, mm-hmm. You know, in the Shia branch of faith. There, it is recommended to offer as many as 1,000 rakahs of prayer, but no one from the religious authorities have ever said that we should offer those, you know, that those 1,000 rakahs of prayer in Jama'ah. That's forbidden according to Shia, according to the Shia religious authorities, and based on the fatwa of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. Mm-hmm. And so it is wrong. It is not permissible to offer any mustahab prayers in Jama'ah.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away. La ilaha
illallah, wallahu akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker in the studio. We are talking about jurisprudential laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei about prayer and Friday prayer. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law about a person, in fact, or a group of people who come to a mosque to offer prayers individually, while at the same time you see the prayer congregation, in fact, is being held?
You're right. So there is a congregational prayer in progress, and there are people who want to offer individual prayers.
Right.
Well, if this act is seen as something which weakens the congregational prayer or leads to kind of disrespect towards the imam or the prayer leader, or it amounts to a kind of insult to the prayer leader,
right,
who is considered just by the people, who is considered adil by the people, then according to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is not, and it will not be permissible to offer individual prayers, you know, because it does have some kind of, you know, implication. And that is, when you start offering individual prayers, it means to some people it might be considered a kind of insult to the prayer leader.
Mm-hmm.
It might be considered a kind of insult to the ongoing congregational prayer. So that's why, if that is the case, and if that is what may be perceived by people, then it's necessary to avoid offering your prayers individually. It becomes haram to offer prayer because it's haram to insult the prayer leader.
Right.
And the prayer leader is considered as just, as adil, as someone whose character is unblemished. And you are signifying by offering your individual prayer that he is not, you know, just. That's not
but
correct.
But if there is no ill intention on the part of that individual coming to the mosque.
Sure. If that's not the case, then of course everybody can offer his own prayers, individual prayers.
Yes.
You can offer prayers at a corner of the mosque. Other people can also do the same.
Right.
And usually it's not the case, you know. Some people are in a hurry,
mm-hmm.
and they want to, for example, catch up with
right.
something they in their daily activities.
Yes.
So they usually offer their prayers individually. The congregational prayer takes a long time, and people may not, you know, make mm-hmm. time to offer it.
As I can recall, Sheikh Javed, well, you talked about some of the conditions to be met by, the personalities and attributes held by the prayer leader
yes.
or imam. And one of them was justice, right?
Yes, you're right.
And if one of the prayer leaders or imams, in fact, makes a joke,
yes,
which is somehow inappropriate or considered as inapt, you know, as for a scholar of Islam, does his justice become void?
Well, we should see understand that joking per se is not haram, you know. You can joke as long as it does not contravene Islamic mm-hmm. law,
right.
as long as it does not go against Islamic Sharia, as long as it does not amount to insulting or backbiting or does not lead to such thing,
right.
then there's no problem. And it does not have any negative effect it does not have any effect on someone being just, on the justice
mm-hmm.
of someone. So obviously joking does not take a person out of justice.
Mm-hmm.
He will remain just.
All right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Thank you for listening to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight.
The long oppressed people of Bahrain have a date with destiny, and their democratic aspiration will eventually triumph over the repression of a ruthless and unrepresentative regime, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading, Is the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime nearing its end? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. We seem to be living in a topsy-turvy world, where realities are ignored and facts are disregarded, while forgeries, fabrications, and falsities circulate from the corridors of power in the capitals of the West to the pompous palaces of their unelected clients in the Arab world, with reverberations in the halls of the United Nations as well. One such center of corruption, repression, and perversion in our own region is the Persian Gulf statelets of Bahrain, which, while brutally suppressing the vast majority of the local population, hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet in the hope of averting the inevitable, that is, the imminent end of the Al Khalifa minority regime of pirate origin. We'll be right back. Now the tyrannical Sheikh Hamad, who since 2010 likes to call himself king, a title never used by his sire since their occupation of Bahrain in the early 19th century, has entered into an unnatural alliance with the illegal Zionist entity in the vain hope of survival. Though the Zionist premier Naftali Bennett visited Manama last February and spoke bombastic words of support for the Sheikh, he was not able to calm down the paranoia of his host about the Islamic Republic of Iran, whose principal policy of defending the rights of the oppressed people all over the world is making Hamad and his ilk increase their brutalities against the people of Bahrain. Even the Sheikh American overlords are beginning to admit that the Al-Khalifa regime, in response to these fears, has imposed repression at home. According to statistics released by human rights bodies, in the last decade, death sentences have risen by 600%, and the political opposition has been thrown behind bars. Some 1,400 political prisoners are incarcerated in a single prison. The right of prisoners to weekly video calls with family members has been suspended in an arbitrary manner, and torture allegations are routine. Bahrain ranked 168 out of 180 countries on the 2021 World Press Freedom Index compiled by Reporters Without Borders, and it was the 144 out of 167 countries in the Economist Intelligence Unit's Democracy Index. Freedom House gave Bahrain miserable rankings in 2020 in political rights and internet freedom. Plus, reports are rife in the Western media that with Britain's connivance, the minority regime is subjecting underage children to imprisonment and threatening them with rape. At the same time, the Zionist technology is being used to spy on not just the dissidents, but on ordinary citizens by eavesdropping on their phone conversations, which is indicative of the extreme fear in which the Al-Khalifa regime is engulfed. It is clear that neither the U.S. nor the Zionists can prolong the survival of such a shaky and savage regime that sooner or later will be a thing of the past. The long-oppressed people of Bahrain have a date with destiny, and their democratic aspiration will eventually triumph over the repression of a ruthless and unrepresentative regime.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Russia and Ukraine account for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market.
The economic impacts of this crisis, of this war, is not something that we're going to be able to that the world will not be able to undo, even if there is a peace treaty in the short term, because the disruptions and the lack of confidence in the old geopolitical arrangements is a permanent damage that will profoundly affect the world economy.
What should be taken into account is that you can't simply remove a cog from the system and expect it to continue working without a hitch. Sanctions might hurt Russia for the short term, but in the long run, everyone will lose.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded 7 Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned 2 major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions. And countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former U.S. officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S. In case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the Laughlin government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and president Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years? the Western media's portrayal of Ukraine's suffering as somehow different compared to those suffering from wars in other countries like Yemen, Libya, Ethiopia, Palestine, and Syria has sparked widespread criticism. News coverage of civilian Ukrainians defending their country by making Molotov cocktails and arming themselves with the state-given machine guns has also been celebrated as heroic, and these people have been called freedom fighters. This empathy has not been voiced for others, like Palestinians who experience an identical crisis, yet are labeled terrorists when defending their land. The suffering in Ukraine must be highlighted. However, portraying Ukraine's pain as more human shows the deep hypocrisy at play. Now, the West has come under criticism over what is seen as double standards regarding conflicts in other parts of the world.
You're happy to correctly use the most strong and robust language to describe the crimes against humanity of Vladimir Putin, but you will not use the same strength of language when it comes to describing the Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, when it is now being documented and detailed by two of the most respected human rights organizations in the world, and indeed has been alleged by dozens and dozens of non-governmental organizations, and to be honest, anybody who looks honestly.
Barrett asked whether the Irish Parliament will impose sanctions against Israel. He also asked whether the Irish legislative body would support calls for referring Israel to international courts over its crimes against humanity. This is not the first time the Western media has shown its bias. A similar narrative was pushed against Palestinians last year. Israel's decades-long occupation, its crippling blockade and military grip over Palestinians, as well as a wave of demolitions, led to a two-week war that killed around 260 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. News outlets and political figures spoke out on the conflict, but it started with the opposite end of the story, starting with Palestinian reactions and violence. While Israel was the real aggressor, they focused on rockets fired by the Hamas resistance movement that came later in retaliation. The double standards of the US and the West are the focal point of tension, violence, and bloodshed, and make Washington an unacceptable mediator and a country that is unable to achieve stability in the world. The war in Yemen is another example. Scant coverage of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis killed by arms from Western countries, especially the US. Yet the media portrays the real Yemeni army as the aggressor, and the ones doing the bombing as the ones who are following the path of righteousness. More than 1.3 million Ukrainians have fled their homeland so far since the beginning of the conflict with Russia. Countries like Hungary and Poland are being praised for letting in tens of thousands of people, and the EU is preparing measures that would offer temporary residence permits, as well as access to employment and social welfare. But the open-door policy of several states has highlighted an apparent double standard. These refugees can enter some countries more easily than those escaping violence in the Middle East or North Africa. For instance, Poland has welcomed those fleeing the Ukraine war while it pushed back against a wave of immigrants crossing over from Belarus, mostly from the Middle East and Africa, last year. Also, the reporting of this tragedy has seen double standards and Eurocentric bias that hold one group of human lives more valuable than others who are suffering conflicts in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
This was just one of many remarks on media outlets drawing a line between the conflict unfolding in Ukraine and those in other parts of the world. Many also drew a comparison between Europe's welcoming of Ukrainian refugees and the influx of Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans, which was declared a migrant crisis. The suffering of refugees from these countries is being played down and almost made to seem that their lives are not as important in comparison to the lives of those fleeing Ukraine. The Western media have been doing a biased reporting of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. The dehumanization of people of color, of those from countries that are not in the West, needs to stop. More needs to be done to improve for the future of building a united, wider society, which values every single person as a human being.
Russia's decision to attack Ukraine has ushered in a new era in its relations with the West. The United States and its allies are supplying Ukraine with arms and providing it with intelligence to fight Russian troops. But they are not directly involved in the clashes.
The only way to actually implement something like a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes into Ukrainian airspace and to shoot down Russian planes. And that could lead to a full-fledged war in Europe. President Biden has been clear that we are not going to get into a war with Russia.
Of course the U.S. doesn't want that, because if a war breaks out between the West and Russia, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. To avoid the doomsday scenario, the West has resorted to another form of warfare, the economic type. The United States and many of its allies have announced unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its financial, banking, and oil and gas sector, among others. These include sanctions on Russia's central bank, exclusion of several Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system, and a ban on Russian banks and companies' access to Western capital markets. In other words, Russia's engagement in dollar-denominated business will be severely affected. But let's not forget that for every action, there will be an opposite reaction.
Look, the dominance of the dollar has afforded America great global power, but it is now under real threat as never before, as Russia, China, and others economically challenge the US. Many are now seeking to ditch their dependence on the dollar, as Washington has continued to abuse its status as issuer of the world's reserve currency for decades, really, since after the Second World War.
Russia has already been working on plans to reduce its dependence on the trade in the dollar. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing for the opening of the Winter Olympic Games in China in early February and met with his Chinese counterpart. It was President Xi Jinping's first face-to-face meeting with another head of state in nearly 2 years, which highlights the importance of the visit. The two leaders discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. Russia has been pursuing the policy for a while. Back in April 2021, the share of Russian exports in dollars fell below 50% for the first time. Moscow's trade with Beijing is mostly responsible for the dive. There's room for improvement, though, as a majority of trade between China and Russia is done in euro, with just over 30% of the transactions conducted in their national currencies. The sweeping sanctions on Russia may push China to speed up measures to break with the US currency and create its own means of payment. The obvious option is the yuan, which is getting stronger than ever. In July, international trade in the Chinese currency set a new record, with many predicting that at this rate, the yuan will become the world's third strongest currency by 2030.
Beijing has been actively encouraging the use of its currency in trade transactions, especially under its massive Belt and Road Initiative, with China recovering more strongly than other big nations after the COVID crisis that we've had. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as Beijing opens its financial markets.
This means only one thing. Given the economic alliance between China and Russia, the sanctions might temporarily hurt Moscow, but in the long run, the West will be disarmed of its economic pressure tool.
The last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are our.
of human volition and thought.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. The listeners, we had been discussing a chain of narrations that says that after Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family, there will be 12 caliphs or successors who will represent Islam, who will take care of Islam, and these 12, Dr. Karimi said, will be one after the other. They will be infallibles. They'll be all from Quraysh and they'll all be from Bani Hashim. Dr. Karimi, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
My pleasure.
We discussed so many ahadiths and we reached a point that the number of caliphs after Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his family that is discussed in the Sunni sources is 12 in all narrations. There's not a difference in number in any of the other sources. The number is perfect, that's 12. However, Sunni brothers have failed to give an understanding of these 12 caliphs, who these 12 are. And among Shias is that there's a group, Isna Ashariya, a major group, who believes in 12 imams. And they have reached a conclusion that these 12 caliphs are the 12 imams. Even many Sunni brothers, you said, who have researched, who are great scholars, say that Imam Mahdi is among those caliphs. Now, I would want you to expand another hadith today, which is the hadith of Saqalain, which says in that hadith, Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his family, he says that, I am leaving among you two great things that are weighty things. One is the Quran, and second is my Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salam, who will not get separated from each other until they meet me at the House of Kawthar. Can you explain how this hadith can, you know, shed light on the appearance of Imam, that yes, it proves that Imam does exist?
Sure. The first one that I would like to share with dear listeners is that many people, maybe both Shia and Sunni, I mean, they have heard about hadith of Thaqalain, but many people think that the version of the Shia is Kitabullahi wa Itrati, I'm leaving two precious things, that are the Book of God, the Quran, and the
Ahlul
Bayt, the progeny of the Prophet. And the Sunni version is Kitab Allahi wa Sunnati, the Book of God and my tradition, my Sunnah. So in that case, the Hadith of Thaqalain, according to Sunni narration and Sunni version, has nothing to do with the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet. This is wrong. We have many narrations in Sunni sources in which the same notion has been mentioned, referring to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet. I would like to share a couple of these narrations.
That's important, actually.
Yeah, giving the addresses also from Sunni sources to remove these misunderstanding. We have different versions of it, I mean, with different words. In one of them, for example, the Holy Prophet says, "Inni tarikum fikum al-thaqalain," I'm leaving among you two precious things. One of them is greater than the other. One is Kitabullah, the Book of God, the Noble Book of Quran, وَعِتْرَةِ أَهْلِ بَيْتِ, my progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, وَإِنَّهُمَا لَنْ يَفْتَرِقَ حَتَّى يَرِدَ عَلَيَّ الْحَوْزِ, they will not separate until they come to me at the pond of Kawthar. This is mentioned in Musnad Ahmad ibn Hanbal, one of the very famous Sunni source of hadith, volume 3, page 14. Also by Shaybani, another great Sunni scholar, in Fada'il al-Sahaba, volume 2, page 779. So this is one version. Thaqalain and Lan Yaftariqa, two precious things, they will not be separated. In another version, we have Tarikun Fikum Khalifatain, and again Lan Yaftariqa, I'm leaving among you two successors, two caliphs. So this is interesting. I mean, even when it comes to the versions, there are different words in Sunni sources referring to different features of these two precious things. So, for example, let me share one narration in this regard. Zayd ibn Thabit, one of the famous companions of the Prophet, says that the Holy Prophet said, "Inni tarikum fikum khalifatain," I'm leaving among you two khalifas, two, I mean, successors, something that you can refer to after me. Kitabullah, one of them is the Book of God, the Quran, and the second one is Itrati Ahl Bayti, my progeny, and they will not be separated from each other till the Day of Judgment. Again, Musnad Ahmad ibn Hanbal, volume 5, page 181, and Fada'il al-Sahaba by Shaybani, volume 2, page 603. The third version is as follows. This one is from Abu Sa'id Khidri, another great companion of the Prophet. According to him, the Holy Prophet said, قَدْ تَرَكْتُمْ فِيكُمْ مَا إِنْ أَخَذْتُمْ بِهِ لَنْ تَضِلُّوا بَعْدِي. I'm leaving among you what, if you adhere to after me, you will never go astray after me. الثقلين, they are two precious things. One of them is greater than the other, that is the Quran. And the other is Itrati Ahl Bayti, my progeny, and they will not be separated from each other. So another version, is interesting to know that it has been mentioned by Tirmidhi, one of the greatest Sunni scholars of Hadith, in his As-Sunan, which is one of the six canonical collections of Hadith, As-Sahah Sitta, volume 5, page 663. In some other versions, we read that instead of, for example, ma in akhathum bihi, it's been mentioned ma in tamassaktum bihi, the concept is almost the same. So these are different versions. So we shouldn't think that the only version in Sunni sources is Book of God and the tradition of the Prophet. No, the Book of God and the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet in different terms have been mentioned in different narrations. And I think we have talked about the fact that that version, the Book of God and my Sunnah, my tradition, does not have an authentic chain of the narration according to Sunni scholars. So, but that's a separate discussion.
Well, that's interesting that we have here when we expand the Hadith of Thaqalain.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
in the Sunni school of thought, you said they say the two way he thinks, one is Quran and the other way he thinks is tradition, the Sunnah. While when even we expand that, we see, we analyze these narrations, you say that these are not very authentic. However, the point that was very, very interesting here is that the Sunni scholars discussed that all Sunni scholars are not limited to the notion that the other way he thinks is tradition, the Sunnah. They have said that the other precious thing is Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
And the more interesting than that was one of the Sunni scholars narrated, adhere to them.
Mm-hmm.
Adhere to them, otherwise you'll go astray. And that's what even we believe.
Exactly.
And even if we put Ahlul Bayt in front of a mirror, it will reflect Sunnah. And if we put Sunnah in front of a mirror, it will reflect Ahlul Bayt.
Very beautifully put, yeah, thank you. So that is one point, the fact that, as you mentioned also, we have the version of the Book of God and the Ahlul Bayt, the progeny of the Prophet, in Sunni sources. What about the chain of the narration? I mean, what is the viewpoint of Sunni scholars regarding these narrations, which mention Ahlul Bayt as the second weighty things? In terms of the chain of the narration, so this is also a very important point. Again, the interesting point is that many Sunni scholars of Hadith and Ilm al-Rijal, which talk about the authenticity of the narrators of the narration, they have explicitly mentioned that this is an authentic narration. They have either mentioned Hassan or Sahih, and both of them are accepted by the Sunni scholars. For example, again, Tirmidhi, after quoting this narration from Zayd ibn Sabit, says that Hada Hadithun Hasan, which means that this is an authentic narration. in Sunan Tirmidhi, volume 5, page 663. Hakim Nishaburi, the famous Sunni scholar who wrote Al-Mustadrak ala Sahihain, after quoting the narration from Zayd ibn Arqam, another companion of the Prophet, he says, هذا حديث صحيح على شرط الشيخين ولم يخرج. This is an authentic narration based on the criteria of Muslim and Bukhari, although they have not quoted it. Ibn Kathir al-Dimashqi, the famous Salafi scholar who is famous for some of his anti-Shia viewpoints, he mentions that وَقَدْ ثَبَتَ فِي الصَّحِيحِ أَنَّ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ. It's been mentioned in an authentic narration that the Holy Prophet in his sermon on the day of Ghadir Khum said that I'm leaving among you two precious things, the Book of God and my Ahlul Bayt. So Ibn Kathir also says that this is an authentic narration. This is in Tafsir al-Quran al-Azim, volume 4, page 114. Abu al-Hasan Haythami, in his famous book Majmu' al-Zawa'id, he quotes the narration which talk about Khalifatain, I'm leaving among you two successors. He says that Rawahu Ahmad ibn Hanbal has quoted this narration, wa sanaduhu jayyid, and it has a good chain of the narration. This is in Majmu' al-Zawa'id, volume 9, page 163. Also, many other Sunni scholars, like for example As-Suyuti, he also narrates the same narrations, and he says that they are, authentic narrations. My dear listeners can refer to Al-Khasa'is al-Kubra, volume 2, page 466. Also, Subul al-Huda by As-Salihi al-Shami, volume 11, page 6. And among the contemporary Sunni scholars, let me just refer to Albani, the famous Sunni or Wahhabi scholar who passed about 25 years ago. He has quoted this narration in his book Sahih al-Jam al-Saghir, and according to him, this narration is also authentic. So all these references, Sunni books, refer to the fact that the version which talks about two precious things being the Book of God and the Etra, the progeny of the Prophet, they are mentioned in authentic Sunni sources, and the chain of the narration is also authentic.
Hold me by your hand and please show me the way to be one of the pure and chosen companions, so that I can swear the oath of allegiance. I'll give everything that I love in God's name to avenge the blood of your grandfather Hussein. Every step of the way my dream will come true. On my last breath, oh Master, I'll call out to you. O Light of Allah, you are my true guide. I'm waiting for you to die by your side.
Now we need to prove that how this hadith of Thaqalain proves the existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Inshallah, in the following session, I will refer to two scholars, one Shia scholar and one Sunni scholar, and mention their arguments to prove the existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam based on hadith of Thaqalain.
Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, especially for providing the addresses, because those addresses after the narrations are really, really helpful here, especially for the seminary students and for the researchers who want to know more about Mahdawiyat, who want to research, basically, because as we said in the previous sessions, that it's really important to analyze these narrations to see who are these 12 caliphs and what do Sunni scholars say, what do Shia scholars say. It's really important to know all that. It's really important to shed light on that, and you helped us providing the addresses. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for coming up with the narrations that say, you said that narrations of Qadir, which say that the first Imam or the first successor was selected as Imam Ali and mentioned in the Sunni sources, and the last Imam would be Imam Mahdi al-Islam. So first and 12 is clear, alhamdulillah. Inshallah, I'll be expanding this topic with you in another session. We'll discuss how these narrations prove the existence of Imam. Thank you so much, listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. Till then, this is Zainab with her whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please
10 minutes.
The Russian attack on Ukraine. The power keg finally exploded on the 24th of February, not after months, but years of tension between NATO and Moscow, turning the Cold War between Russia and the West hot again. The finger of blame immediately fell on the Russian president. This was always about naked aggression, about Putin's desire for empire by any means necessary. The US president rushed to condemn the attack on the very same day. Biden, however, didn't bother to draw attention to NATO's arrogant policy towards Russia over the past quarter century. As the most powerful military alliance in history, NATO has long been creeping towards Russia without heeding Moscow's warnings. As they say, the first casualty when war comes is truth. On February 9, 1990, and in the process of German unification, then US Secretary of State James Baker's famously assured Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO expansion would not be one inch eastward. And it was just part of a cascade of assurances about Soviet security made by Western leaders to Gorbachev and other Soviet officials. But in practice, the West backtracked on its promise. The first move was initiated under Bill Clinton in 1993, when his administration proposed inviting Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary to become NATO members, which the US Senate finally approved in 1998. The first wave of membership expansion was met with a strong reaction by the Russians. In her memoir, Madeleine Albright, Clinton's Secretary of State, writes, "Russian President Boris Yeltsin and his countrymen were strongly opposed to enlargement, seeing it as a strategy for exploiting their vulnerability and moving Europe's dividing line to the east, leaving them isolated. In spite of Moscow's objection, US and NATO leaders proceeded with new rounds of expansion, taxing the patience of the Russians. In 2004, three former Soviet republics, namely Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, were brought into NATO. Meanwhile, American rockets were placed in Poland and Romania, and Ukraine was armed with Western weaponry. In March 2007, Vladimir Putin gave his last friendly warning at the annual Munich Security Conference. He said, "NATO has put its frontline forces on our borders. Its expansion represents a serious provocation that reduces the level of mutual trust. And we have the right to ask, against whom is this expansion intended? And what happened to the assurances our Western partners made after the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact?" Putin's warnings went practically unheard. Instead, the US tried to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, recklessly ignoring what the Russians regarded as their own vital national interests. In retrospect, the Obama administration's interference in Ukraine's internal political affairs in 2013 and 2014 to help demonstrators overthrow Ukraine's elected pro-Russia president was the last straw. In recent months, the Kremlin demanded that NATO provide assurances that the organization would reduce the scope of its military presence in Eastern Europe and would never offer membership to Ukraine. The Biden administration's response was, however, disappointing. Now Washington's attempt to make Ukraine a NATO pawn has cost the Ukrainian people dearly. The current escalation has yet another side to reveal: Western hypocrisy and double standards. The attack on Ukraine has drawn strong condemnation by almost all Western countries and has triggered immediate sanctions by the United States and other countries targeting Russian banks, oil refineries and military exports. The speed of such an international response has raised eyebrows at the lack of such a reaction to other conflicts across the world. At the same time, the mainstream media have been accused of using their outlets to not only praise Ukraine's resistance to Russian troops, but also to underline their shock at how such a conflict could happen to a civilized nation. What CBS News senior correspondent in Kiev, Charlie DeAgata, said when describing the event is just a case in point.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
As just another example, the British writer Daniel Hannan wrote in The Telegraph, "They seem so like us. That is what makes it shocking. War is no longer something visited upon impoverished and remote populations. It can happen to anyone."
Vladimir Putin is prepared to use barbaric and indiscriminate tactics against innocent civilians, to bomb tower blocks, to send missiles into tower blocks, to kill children, as we're seeing in increasing numbers.
Such statements in the mainstream media have contributed to the further dehumanization of non-white, non-European people suffering from conflicts mostly caused by NATO forces, troops with blue eyes and blonde hair. Mostly caused by NATO forces, troops with blue eyes and blonde hair. From this particular point of view, Libyan, Afghan, Iraqi and Syrian lives don't matter, for they are looked upon as uncivilized. A desperate Syrian refugee recently told Reuters, "We are wondering, why were Ukrainians welcome in all countries while we Syrian refugees are still in tents and remain under the snow, facing death, and no one is looking to us?" Even European politicians have expressed support for open borders towards Ukrainian refugees, referring to them as intellectuals and European, in a stark contrast with the rhetoric they have been using for migrants and refugees from Africa, the Middle East and Central Asia. In the words of Jean-Louis Brulange, a member of the French National Assembly, the Ukrainian refugees will be an immigration of great quality, intellectuals, those whom we will be able to take advantage of. In fact, the sorrow and despair the West is feeling for Ukraine has not been identical to the sorrow and despair it feels for Yemen, Palestine and Syria, or other war-torn nations in the region. If war is bad, it is bad for all humanity. This selective empathy and sympathy means the West has still a long way to go to really believe in what it has long been preaching the world about: human lives matter, no matter where they belong to.
IRIB English Radio.